This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Forget the frustration of picking commerce platforms when you switch your business to Shopify, the global commerce platform that supercharges your selling wherever you sell. With Shopify, you'll harness the same intuitive features, trusted apps, and powerful analytics used by the world's leading brands. Sign up today for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/tech, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/tech.
News, weather, traffic, money, politics, big interviews, and bold opinions. It's what's happening right now. This is Mornings with Simi.
I'd be honest, does that song make you kind of want to move around, maybe dance a little bit? Maybe you want to move around even if you're not on a dance floor. Like, some songs just do that to us, don't they? You hear it and you think, oh, I really want to start moving. Why is that? Is there some kind of secret formula to it? Actually, yes, there might be. This is something that has been studied, actually. Dr. Benjamin Morland is a cognitive neuroscientist at Aix-Marseille University's Institute of Neurosciences and joins us now to talk about that. Thank you so much for being here.
Hello, Simi. Thanks for having me.
Well, we want to talk about music. This is your area of expertise. So you tell me, is there some kind of secret code that makes us want to dance when it comes to music?
So there surely is, because, you know, the professional musicians, they definitely know how to make us dance, you know. They know how to make a hit. If you think about Stevie Wonder, for example, he was maybe for me the best expert. You listen like for 30 seconds of music and you can't help yourself but moving.
That's very true. Are some songs better at it than others? Like, I'm thinking Superstition is a great Stevie Wonder song.
Yeah, what is amazing, Superstition, you know, you just have the drum and the bass, and just with these two instruments, you can't help yourself but moving. So it's very much like the rhythmic aspect of the music that is a key player here to activate automatically your body.
So it's like a key.
Yes, a key player. Of course, there are many things that want to make us dance. You know, for example, if we enjoy your music, we love it, it's bringing good memories. Maybe we want to dance on it if we are, you know, in a club. But there are some objective aspects that are quite universal and that everyone prefers some things than others.
Now, you studied the brain for this, right? So could you see the brain, like if you scanned the brain, can you see how it responds to certain beats, certain kinds of music?
Yes, exactly. So what we did was recording the electromagnetic activity of the brain. So you see like brain waves, brain rhythms, brain oscillations. So you see live how the brain reacts to sounds that you present to healthy participants. And you try to see which regions are activated, how the auditory system that perceives the sounds connects with the motor systems that is involved in preparing movements. And so we can study that. Of course, it takes many years. You don't see that in 5 minutes. You need to work like 4 years. But in the end, you're able to have a good picture of what's happening there.
So what is the code? What is it called, these different things that make us want to move in music?
Okay, so as I told you, there are multiple facets. So some melodies, you prefer them, some songs. But one thing that is clear is about the rhythm, and it's called syncopation. Okay, the syncopation is a bit the complexity that is present in the rhythm. And actually, you know, the first work on this topic in neuroscience came from Canada, especially labs in Montreal, Concordia University, and also in Toronto. Some researchers have started to study this aspect and why the syncopation makes us want to move.
Why does it make us want to move?
So one question that I like about this is that, so first, dancing is a bit weird, you know, it's universal, every culture dance, but it's weird, you know, why do we dance? You know, you perceive sound waves in your ears and you can't help yourself but to move your body. It's a bit weird, don't you think? I always find that fascinating, and the more I think about it, the more I think, well, why do all humans dance? And there are some studies showing that some animals dance too, some parrots, some sea whales, but it's quite rare in the animal kingdom. Another thing that is fascinating for me is why how do you perceive time? Okay. And if we think about rhythm in music, it's all about time. Okay. Estimating the duration between two events. That's how you perceive the tempo and the beat. And the cool thing in our brain is that we perceive time through our motor system. Okay. Time perception, if you estimate a duration, short or long, it's involving the same neurons that are implicated in movement. So for me, this is quite fascinating. We perceive time with the neurons that are involved in movement. That's weird.
Okay. Yeah, it is. The way you're describing it, I'm trying hard to concentrate. So there's certain beats in the music that just respond to our brain. And so when the music is designed a certain way, it's almost going to force our brain to move.
On a night cold enough to freeze your bones, a prospector searching for a legendary cursed gold mine vanishes without a trace. I'm Crew Williams, the host of Dead Man's Curse. This season, we retrace the steps of fortune seekers looking for a motherlode worth billions who never came back. Join our quest June 3rd. Search for and follow Dead Man's Curse Volcanic Gold on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Amazon Music, and wherever you find your favorite podcasts.
Yeah, so the hypothesis we had is that many studies have shown that when you try to estimate an interval between two sounds, you use your motor system to estimate the duration, okay, to perceive time. And the question was more, if the rhythm is very simple, very periodic, will you use a lot your motor system? So will you dance to that? So maybe we can play an example of music that is with no syncopation, so very rhythmic.
Okay, let's play the low one. Okay, is that designed to make us move? You kind of want to move just a little bit.
Yeah, so it's not amazing. So, of course, all these excerpts are from very stereotypical. So you just have a simple drum and a simple bass, and they just play together at a rate of 100 BPM. But then we said, okay, so it doesn't seem to work. So if we increase the degree of syncopation, so the rhythm is more complex. So maybe you can play the medium one.
So it's picking up the pace.
Yeah. So here, what you observe, what you call syncopation, is that sometimes the drum and the bass, they are playing at the same moment. And sometimes the bass is doing his own stuff and playing alone. Okay? So the two instruments are partly agreeing about when to play. So that's what we call syncopation. And then we can even increase more this degree of complexity and have a highly syncopated rhythm.
Let's hear that one. And so is it the higher the syncopation, then the more the urge to dance?
No. So what's clearly interesting, so you have multiple hypotheses. And if it's too complex, too syncopated, people don't want to dance. You know, if you listen to free jazz in a club, some people dance. But most people, they dance to music that is a bit simpler than that. And you don't dance too much to music that is very simple, like the music that kids love to listen to, like babies. Usually adults, they don't dance to that. So the idea is that for the highly syncopated music, the drum and the bass, they never play together. So they never agree. And so your brain cannot make sense of what's happening. You know, it's too complex. So because it's too complex, it can't move in reaction to the music because it doesn't understand what's happening.
Right. This is fascinating. I'm going to be so paying attention now the next time I feel the urge to move with music comes on. Listen, thank you so much for your time today. We appreciate that.
Thanks a lot. Have a nice day.
You too. Well, got that explained to me too. Now you have to think about what songs make you want to move. That is Dr. Benjamin Morland, who's a cognitive neuroscientist at Aix-Marseille University's Institute of Neurosciences. That is really the code, the secret code kind of to how music makes us want to move.
This is Mornings with Simi.
Now, we play that song every morning at this time because it is the song that Vaughn Palmer loves to dance to, isn't it, Vaughn?
I'm tempted to say that, Simi, but you know that great song, Play That Funky Music, White Boy?
Yes.
That perfectly captures my complete clumsiness and inability and lack of timing. My timing is so bad, I throw everybody else off when I'm clapping.
Would you say it's like Elaine Bennis on Seinfeld? Are you that kind of a dancer? Is that what that is?
I'll say yes, even though I don't get the cultural reference.
Oh, so you got to look that up. I'll send you a clip. I'll send you a clip on that one. Okay, Vaughn, we have a lot to talk about today because it's been a very busy week in BC politics because it was the last kind of legislature session until the election.
Yes, and a very busy legislature session and an awful lot happened, but I think we should do the highlights package. At least the biggest thing that, to me anyway, happened during the legislature session was the emergence of the BC Conservatives as the NDP's main challenger in the fall election. Now, that comes with a few asterisks, because as you know, the situation is fluid and in motion. But go back to the beginning of the session. We started to see opinion polls, Simi, that showed the gap between the NDP and the Conservatives was narrowing, and the gap between the Conservatives and BC United was widening. Our first reaction was, this is an outlier. Right? But when you started to see that in poll after poll after poll, by the end of the session, it's pretty obvious. John Rustad is the leader of the party that is most likely to contend with the NDP for government in the fall. BC United, Kevin Falcon, they're fading. And I think all the parties, in their own roundabout way, have kind of recognized that.
Okay. And the last, I think, 48 hours in particular, Vaughn, I mean, there are merger talks. There aren't merger talks. It just seems crazy.
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's a math question, really. If you add the BC United vote to the BC Conservative vote, if you could somehow or other combine those two votes together, then suddenly we're into a dead heat. The New Democrats have won most of their elections in the past, and so 2021 is unusual, but they've won most of their elections in the past by their opposition being divided among two or three parties. Well, if you could combine that center-right opposition, everybody knows it, everyone says it, even the New Democrats acknowledge it privately, then you're into a very, very competitive election. If it doesn't happen, well, the government has a very good chance of winning another term this fall, because even though a large number of British Columbians aren't happy with the NDP record, and see that in the polls too, they're going to spread their votes around. They're British Columbians. They don't necessarily have a consensus. So unless you can provide them with that single vehicle, a vote for this party and it will defeat the government, you're less likely to defeat the government. Now, you know, you talk to the Conservatives, they'll tell you, oh, we're going to be that party. Look at how fast we've grown. Look how far we've come. Maybe right. The merger talks, they've been derailed. I mean, there's talks, but they've been derailed by, well, what we saw yesterday with John Rustad. He's not going anywhere. He's made it very, very clear. He's not stepping aside. He plans to lead his party in the election, and he plans to run a full slate of candidates. Kevin Falcon. Yes, he's interested and he's talking, and no, he wouldn't rule things out. But on the other hand, he says he can't imagine himself voting for and supporting and aligning with the Conservatives, given some of what Kevin Falcon regards as the wackos that are running for the Conservatives. And he gave us a couple of examples of that. So you got the New Democrats standing there kind of mocking all this. And so far, the mocking is warranted. You can talk about it as much as you want, but unless you can come up with a plan to unite the two parties into a single party that would beat the government, mock away. It's just fun speculation. I'm in the speculation business, Simi. I expect to go on speculating about this probably until election day. But
of course we will. That's what we do. That is what we
do. Also, it's easy for us to talk about it without coming up with a plan for exactly how to do it.
I know. We don't have to do that. We don't. That's not our job. But I have to talk about yesterday in the legislature, because you talked about there was some mocking going on, but there was also there was some sweet stuff too, because it was Mike DeYoung's last day in the legislature. And I have to say, I love the wood splitter joke.
Yeah, you know, DeYoung is amazing and regarded very highly. on both sides of a house. He's recognized, he'd been there 30 years. He's recognized as, you know, one of the most important MLAs in modern times, whatever you think of the stuff he did. And he also has got a terrific sense of humor. So all of the members that are not running again are giving their farewell speeches in the legislature. I tell you, there was a lot of interest in DeYoung's farewell speech. I watched it from the public gallery because I thought this is an important moment to see. And I, what I was really struck by was Premier David Eby on the floor, Ravi Kalon, government house leader on the floor, Mike Farnworth, DeYoung's great friend on the government side, on the floor, listening and enjoying the speech as much as any member of the opposition. They expected to be entertained, and they were. A lot of the jokes about DeYoung are how frugal he is. I'd say stingy. I mean, he's cheap. He's still driving the same car. See, he walked into the house wearing the same suit.
Okay, I saw that on social media. Is that true?
The house. Yeah, it's a bit shiny, but, you know, on the other hand, he drives the same car, a 30-year-old Miata. So DeYoung has a joke about that himself. He says, people are asking me, you've been here 30 years, like, are you going to get anything for all that service? Well, there's a satisfaction, of course. Yeah, but are they going to give you anything? And he goes, well, actually, I have in mind what I'd like as a farewell present from the BC legislature. I'd like the wood splitter. He says, I don't know where it is, but I don't think it would be missed. And it's just, you know, he gets a big laugh all around. And the legislature, BC, it's notorious for all sorts of things. But every now and then there's a moment of grace, and that was one of them.
All right, we are back talking with Vaughn Palmer from the Vancouver Sun with the last session of the legislature wrapped up for this year, an election 5 months away. And this was an important session too, wasn't it, Vaughn, in terms of the, I would say, the inroads that the opposition made?
Yeah, I mean, the job of the opposition is to hold the government to account, point out what it's doing wrong, and in many cases, it makes a it's a negative exercise, but it makes a positive contribution if the government acknowledges the opposition has a point and backs away. Well, we saw a major, major back down this session brought on by the opposition, and that was when the New Democrats backed away from their sweeping decriminalization around the issue of open drug use, particularly in the hospitals. It was BC United that brought the memos into the House that were circulating in the health regions about the chaos in our hospitals because of open drug use. And the New Democrats did what governments always do. They mocked it. They discounted it. They said the memos are out of date and that's not that bad and everything. And the opposition kept at it. The province's nurses lined up and said, oh, yes, that's what's going on in our hospitals. And the government had to back off. They had to, in fact, throw themselves on the mercy of the federal government because they were blocked by the courts and say, you got to change this. You've got to narrow, you've got to restrict the number of places in the province where open drug use is allowed. They admitted grudgingly that the opposition had a point. And so we had a legislature session where the opposition did its job and the government backed off. And the thing I guess we'll be looking at, Simi, between now and the election is whether or not the government's belated response has solved the problem out there. I'm not sure it has. You know, they let loose open drug use in the province. The people that are doing that, it may be very, very difficult to get them to back off what they think they're allowed to do because we effectively legalized open drug use in the province.
Also, another interesting thing that was dropped on that was it Premier David Eby yesterday or the day before who said they were going to put the tracker in the safe supply drugs, or they're looking into that?
Yes, you're right. And so, again, this is something, we're not going to do that. You don't need to do that. You know, you're making this safe supply stuff up. You're exaggerating. Well, Eleanor Sturco, BC United, have been flagging that. Fran Yanner, Northern Beat, has done some terrific work on open drug or a diversion of safe supply. And the solution everybody has said is if you're denying that it's your safe supply drugs that are getting into the illicit market and leading people to drug use, there's a very easy way to do it. You can put a chemical marker in the safe supply drugs that you're dispensing, and when the coroner finds someone who's died from an overdose, they can quickly check. So the government is saying, oh, you don't need to do that. People are exaggerating. Well, the premier, you're right, Simi, in the House yesterday said, yeah, I've asked them to do that. So, you know, government smug and overconfident and all that, and trying to keep the troops rallied and looking at the polls and saying, you know, we're in pretty good shape to win another term. But when you look at what they're actually doing, they're also grudgingly acknowledging that the opposition did a very good job this session of the legislature, and that's really their job. It's the first test, not the only one, of whether or not they're fit to form government is how good are they at opposition.
Okay, so there was that issue as well. And let's talk about what some of the biggest bills were, some of the most important legislation that we saw.
Well, I think the biggest bill that went through the House, actually, and it's one that I think we'll be discovering the implications of going forward. The government itself called the legislation historic. The Premier said it was one of the proudest moments of his political career. And that is the legislation recognizing that the Haida have Aboriginal title over 100% of Haida Gwaii. So this is the first time the government's conceded 100% Aboriginal title. In court, the most the First Nation has been able to get is about 5% of its traditional territory. So the gap is big. What does it mean going forward? I don't think we know. Legislation is not like a treaty and it's not like a court decision. The New Democrats are very proud of this. There's a lot of critics who say this has implication for the management of Crown land and for private property. The government says, no, private property is protected permanently. To that, I say we'll see. This thing is so far reaching that I think we'll be discovering what it really means in the years ahead. And if the New Democrats are reelected, I think we'll see more of this. I think we'll see the government acknowledging, Simi, that a lot of what we call Crown land in this province is actually Indigenous land, and they will be handing over control of that land to the province's 200 First Nations.
Okay, so again, very significant, but do you think the attention turns now that the next 5 months, all we're really going to be seeing and talking about is this election?
Yeah, I think so. Look, you know, we have a sort of fixed election date, although John Horgan didn't respect that. But October the 19th, EB's repeatedly ruled out a snap election. So I don't think he's thinking of such a thing. I think he would be, it would be seen as desperate at this point. An awful lot can turn in 5 months in BC politics. An awful lot can turn in the 4 weeks of an election campaign. So, yeah, it'll be political and politics. They may all take a bit of time off in the summer. The EB household is expecting another child, and the Premier said that that was one reason why he didn't want an election in June. He expects to have his hands full, and he and his wife. So wish them well and good luck in that. And then I think the government and the opposition parties will be firing up and, you know, full-blown election mode by late summer for sure.
All right. Thank you for that, Vaughn.
Bye-bye, Simi.
This is Mornings with Simi.
It's Friday morning, and it's time for us to check in with Reggie Cicchini, our Global News Washington correspondent. There's a lot to catch up on. Things have been happening in the United States. Good morning, Reggie.
Good morning.
Reggie, can we start with something non-political this morning?
Well, absolutely.
Thank you. Okay. This story about Americans being arrested, about what, five of them now in Turks and Caicos because they keep finding ammunition in their luggage. It's crazy. What is going on?
Yeah, look, it's wild, but it also shows that, you know, the laws that exist in one country don't always exist in another country. And you're right. There are now five Americans who have been detained on the island of Turks and Caicos for having ammunition with them. Turks and Caicos does not allow for ammunition or for firearms. And it is a serious offense. And holding ammunition or being caught with it can put you in jail for 12 years. The bigger question here is, in one of these five cases, the ammunition was in a carry-on bag, and the questions are now being pointed back to the TSA to say,
yeah,
how did you not see bullets in a carry-on bag? The rest of them were in checked bags, which also then raises the question, why do people have so much ammunition in their checked baggage all going to this one island?
Okay, that's what I was wondering, right? After the first time, I thought, oh, okay, you know, new law. It is a new law that just recently came into effect. But how does it keep happening? How is the TSA not finding it if it's in a carry-on bag? Like, they'll find all sorts of weird nail clippers, like all that kind of stuff, but they can't find a bullet?
Yeah, I mean, look, the TSA has been, questioned, about not only this story, but in the past for letting weapons through and how they've made their way to, destination A, B, and C beyond where somebody left from. This is just poking more holes into the reasons that TSA gives when they say that, their personnel are doing everything that they can. There's new reviews, there's new measures that are being put in place. But ultimately here, this is a story that has now left five people in custody, unable to leave Turks and Caicos. They have to keep checking in with police every Tuesday and Thursday, I believe, for most of the five. Wow. And if they are found guilty, they may not leave that island for up to 12 years. There's a lot of support coming from people back in the U.S., but there's also a lot of criticism saying, look, check your bags properly.
I know. And I know we see this up at the Canadian border, too. I know CBSA has stories of Americans who come up here and they don't realize that they can't have their guns or whatever the case is. So it happens. It is nuts. But we also,
I mean, look, it's also the same when you see the signs coming into the U.S. that says get rid of the pot out of your car before you cross the border.
But I feel like Canadians know that. We're pretty afraid of the border.
This is true.
I think Canadians are pretty good about, ooh, do not take that to the border. It's just weird that it doesn't work in reverse. But okay, let's talk about some political stories too. Michael Cohen on the stand this week.
Michael Cohen on the stand, and Michael Cohen was grilled yesterday by the defense that at times left Donald Trump smiling, believing that the defense has actually done what it was intended to do, and that is poke holes in Michael Cohen's credibility. Earlier in the week, Michael Cohen testified that Donald Trump was the one directing payments to be made to porn stars to keep negative news out of the public eye before the 2016 election, talking about a phone call where he talked to Donald Trump about that. The defense yesterday ripped it apart, saying, look, the phone call that you had on that October day in 2016 wasn't about payments. It was about the fact that you were getting harassing phone calls, including from a 14-year-old that you wanted to sic the Secret Service on, and that's why you talked to Trump's bodyguard. And said that it had nothing to do with the payment to Stormy Daniels. Whether or not it did or didn't, we have no proof about that. But it's now going to leave the jury sitting thinking, is everything that Michael Cohen is saying, is that a lie? And they're going to be thinking about that for the next several days because court's not in session today or tomorrow or Sunday. And then Cohen's back on the stand for more defense, grilling on Monday. But realistically, whatever he has to say, this is going to wind up in the jury's hands, possibly as early as next week.
Okay, that's something to watch too. And let's talk about the presidential election, because that's what everybody is watching as a result of this case too. So these primaries are still going on, even though we're down to the two candidates, but the Republican side of things is pretty interesting, isn't it?
The Republican side is interesting in primaries, and that's because there is a zombie campaign that is actively underway, and that is of Nikki Haley. As Donald Trump walks away the winner in every single primary campaign and rather primary election, and that's unexpected given the fact that he is the presumptive Republican nominee, Nikki Haley is getting somewhere between 15 and plus 20% of the vote. And that includes in really red states like Indiana or in Nebraska.
But she's been out of this for a long time now.
Yeah, 20 and 22% in both of those states. And what it shows is that there is a protest vote that goes against Donald Trump that is consistent, unlike the protest vote against Joe Biden, which kind of fluctuates. Sometimes it's not there, sometimes it's 10%. This is persistent in every single state that is holding a Republican primary. And the question becomes, where are these voters going to go? Because Donald Trump has already criticized them, saying, look, we don't want you. You were part of the Nikki Haley campaign. In critical swing states later in November, those could be make or break votes, particularly the women in suburban metro centers, places that Joe Biden has won before. If they come over to him or don't vote at all,
right,
that does give a potential advantage to Biden.
Which is so interesting because, I mean, they know she's not on the ballot anymore. They know she's not in the race, and yet they are still voting for her.
And I mean, it's going to start sounding alarm bells inside the Trump campaign. Look, Biden's already worried, or at least the campaign is worried about his poll numbers. If these poll numbers start to drag down under Donald Trump, for as much as, as many grains of salt as we have to give to polling now, because it hasn't really been accurate over the last 8 years, this could be a big deal.
All right. That could be a big deal. Let's talk about some other stuff that's going on out there. So the NFL, obviously, it's in the off season, but yet still making headlines with some of the things that NFL players are saying.
Harrison Butker, Kansas City Chiefs, gave a commencement speech. He gave one
it
in 2023.
Bonkers. Come on.
Well, he gave it in 2023 that sparked controversy about what he said. And then he just kind of re-upped it in 2024. And the big question here is, what is he thinking when there are are cameras on and women in the audience, when he's saying to women, look, don't go out and get a job. Your lot in life is to get married and have kids. And then he goes on these rips against the LGBTQ community and goes on rips against IVF and Biden's handling of COVID. Look, you have political opinions. That's one thing. But then to go out and tell a vast majority of the population that what they're doing in life is based on lies that have been told to them, when your own mother is a renowned physicist. The NFL is walking away. Well, not walking away, is distancing themselves from this. The city of Kansas City is distancing themselves. We haven't heard from the Kansas City Chiefs. But I mean, when you have Travis Kelce and his girlfriend, who is arguably the most popular female on the planet right now,
who he referred to, by the way, in the speech as my teammate's girlfriend. Like, he quoted Taylor Swift and referred to her as my teammate's girlfriend. Like, at least say her name.
At a time when the NFL is actively trying to bring in a bigger female audience.
Look,
there's a lot of questions.
Yeah, that again, bonkers. And I don't want to leave without letting you talk about McDonald's, because I take it you like McFlurries.
I love McFlurries if the machines are working.
Right?
Look, so I'm usually pretty critical. I'm becoming an old man where I'll start saying these
kids.
And it's the Gen Zers who are always, you know, on TikTok and things that I don't really know how to do. But they're all about looking to the past and making it new again. And these Gen Zers are really kind of picking up on grandma's life and knitting and crocheting and baking. And McDonald's is trying to tap into that. This is a company that is struggling with some of its sales. So its new McFlurry is coming out. They haven't really said what it is yet, but Reddit users say that it is going to be Werther's or butterscotch flavored, and they're going to tap into grandma carrying the butterscotches in candies in her pocket and in her purse, and trying to kind of bring people back to a safe space back in the early parts of their life. I mean, I'm all for this. I mean, give me a plain McFlurry and I'll eat it just with the vanilla ice cream.
It's not a McFlurry then. It's just ice cream, Reggie.
I mean, it's still soft serve that comes into a cup. Job was an ice cream scoop. I will take any soft serve that's in a cup. But if you throw some Werther's in there, I mean, it would be hard to chew. But I mean, you put them in your mouth and you
make
suck
it
on
that
them.
Flavor, like, though. I will have that, no problem. I love Werther's. Does that
I love
make
anything
me old?
Well, both of us, because I mean, I like anything that's caramel or butterscotch on vanilla ice cream, but I just like vanilla ice cream. So.
I also just love this. It's pretty cute, though, because the cup is even the limited edition Grandma McFlurry. The cup is even retro.
Yeah.
So it looks like the cup from when I was a kid. It's kind of cute.
It just brings you, I mean, everything that's old is new again, but I mean, I'm the kind of person who would live in the 80s and 90s for the rest of my life. So.
Yeah, probably. Me too. Thank you for that, Reggie.
Thanks.
That's Reggie Cicchini, our Global News Washington correspondent. That's a real thing. I know it sounds like it's made up, but it is actually not. It starts on May the 21st, and they'll have a limited edition. This is probably in the U.S. I don't know if they're doing it here. I doubt it. It's probably just in the U.S. But there is a Grandma McFlurry, and they're doing it with the retro cup and everything. I'm sure it's going to be very, very popular.
This is Mornings with Simi.
You have undoubtedly heard the phrase demovictions. That's where people are moved out and then their relatively affordable old rental building is torn down. And there is just no way they can afford rent in the new building that is put up in its place. Now, it's become all too common here in Metro Vancouver. But, you know, Burnaby has been trying to address this, particularly in the area around Metrotown, where this has been a huge problem. There used to be so many low-rise rental buildings there. So in 2018, Burnaby introduced some tenant protections. And now they might actually be seeing some progress as a result of that. So Mike Hurley is the mayor of Burnaby and joins us now to talk about that. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you so much for having me on.
Do you think Burnaby is making progress against dem evictions?
Oh, yeah. We're starting to turn the corner and start to see some results for all the effort we put into, going to our community and asking them to help us with solutions. And I think finally now we're starting to turn the corner a little bit.
Okay, what makes you say that? Why?
Well, you know, just the other day, some people were starting to move back into their new buildings, and we have many more in progress. And, they're moving back in at the same rents as they left. And they were taken care of by the developers during that time when the building was being built. So now we're starting to see the results.
Okay, so how does that work then? So if you're in a building, a low-rise, like a low-rent building that is going to be torn down, what are the protections that Burnaby has put in place?
Well, the protections are is that that those renters who have been there a long time, you know, it's the responsibility of the developer to top up the rents to what they would have been. Let's say they had $1,000 for rent when they were moved out of the building and they had to move away for a 3-year period for $1,500 a month rent, then the developer would top up that rent for that period of time, you know, $500 a month. And then there's a unit available for them if they wish to move back in at the same rent as they left.
Now, how long does that guarantee last for?
Well, it lasts as long as it takes for the building to go up. So,
right, but once they move back in, so they can move back in at the rent that they were previously paying. Is that right?
Correct. Plus the, you know, the 2.5% that have been added on to rents for that time.
Okay.
And so then 2 years, it was 2.5% additions to those.
Okay. And so then at that point, the rent can only go up by whatever the mandated rent increase is.
Correct. And also, you know, if people don't, like 65% of the people move back into this building, some of them took lump sum payments to move on. Some of them actually used the lump sum payment to buy a unit. So those that don't move back, that 35% that's left is moved into our affordable bank, which is 20% below CMHC average for the area.
Okay.
So they still play. They still stay as affordable rents, even if the tenants don't move back.
So how have developers reacted to this, Mayor Hurley?
Well, at the start, when we first brought it in, I think there was a lot of, you know, concern about it. But I think now that we have made it work, because the idea is that we give them extra density to do this. So we try to make sure that it's not profitable for them, but it breaks even when people move back in. So we're always keeping an eye on how we do that and making sure that we're getting it right for both the developers and the renters. So you know, they get the extra density and they can make it work. And I think most developers now would tell you that it's, you know, it's a good program and we'll have to keep adjusting it because, you know, economics change. But We're working with them to keep doing that.
Would you say they've kind of come around on it? They now see that, okay, it's a little bit easier to work with the city if we do it this way?
Yeah, I think they've come around to see that, you know, it's a break-even process for them to add those extra units because they get the extra density. And I think most developers would say it's working well. There are one or two little things that we need to adjust, but I think it's working well for all parties.
Now, is this particularly for the area in and around Metrotown, or does this apply all over Burnaby?
Well, this is the four town centers anywhere. So we have, you know, the four town centers where you see the towers, anywhere where there's displacement.
Right, okay.
Some of the areas don't have displacement because they're being built in parking lots or something like that.
Right, okay. I guess Brent would be another area that you'd see this.
If there were displacements, yes.
Right. Okay. So would you say then that most people are happy to come back? You said not everybody takes that offer.
No, because some renters want to move to another province. Some, you know, as I said, I know of two who actually use that for a down payment to purchase a place. You know, they take the lump, they ask for a lump sum. It's not something we really like. We would prefer the tenants all to be moving back, but we know that that's not always possible.
Right. What has this done for Burnaby in terms of the workload, right? Because this would be a hard thing to keep track of. This is, you've got to monitor this. You've got to make sure the tenants are getting what they deserve. You have to make sure that the developer is following the rules.
It's certainly another burden. We now have a renter's office that looks after all this for us. And they're certainly busy, as you say, keeping everything in line.
Right. So do you think this is something that other municipalities should take a look at?
Well, I mean, it's worth taking a look at. The economics won't work everywhere. I mean, you have to have a certain level. It won't work for everyone, but I think it could work for some.
It's certainly very interesting. Well, I'm glad to hear it's working. Thank you for your time this morning.
Thank you very much for having me on.
That is Mike Hurley, the mayor of Burnaby, talking about their dem eviction programs. So they're trying to prevent more dem evictions from happening. And this got a lot of headlines, you know, especially in and around the area of Metrotown, where those low rise, kind of affordable rent buildings were being torn down and people were losing their affordable apartments, couldn't afford to rent in the new one. So they put this program into place in 2018, and they are now seeing the results of that. More people are now moving back into their buildings that is guaranteed at the rent that they were paying before. And that is good news for those people, right? But can this work elsewhere? Would you like to see your community do something like this? Let me know. Simi@cknw.com.
This is Mornings with Simi.
I'm very sad I didn't get to watch the third period of that Canucks game last night. I had to go to bed, right? But all you lucky people who got to watch it, oh, we're going to recap it now with the help of Barry DeLay, sports anchor and reporter at Global. Good morning, Barry.
Good morning, Simi. How could you? How could you possibly fall asleep at that situation?
I know. Discipline, Barry. That's what the answer was. I've done it in the past where I've stayed up and I have paid the price. So I couldn't do that.
Sometimes you know you're going to pay the price in the morning, but it's worth it.
I know.
It would have been worth it this time.
I've already done it three times for the Canucks in the playoffs and I just couldn't do it this one more time. I wish I had, because what a game last night. What was different about the Canucks game last night?
It was their best game of the playoffs for sure. After about Edmonton kind of had the puck the first 10 minutes and then the Canucks kind of got their legs and played the way, you know, that's always the game, right? Who can play their game against the other team? Who can force the other team into doing what they want to do? And their forecheck was really awesome. They just pressured them, and they had the puck down in their zone, and the Oilers were just kind of on the ropes. And honestly, you know, the Canucks probably should have won by three or four goals. But that's the kind of series it's been. Both teams have dominated games, but they've always come down to the last the last two games have come down to the last minute. I mean, even dominating, they still had to get a goal with 30 seconds left. But if it was dramatic, that's for sure. And the crowd was so good last night. They were I think for Pettersson especially, he said afterwards, and his teammates said that the chants for Petey were, they meant a lot to him, you know, and he played a better game, I think. I think he still has a ways to go, but he was still, when he can, you know, he was instrumental in the tying goal. So mission accomplished there. So they got one more to go. Tomorrow in Edmonton, 5 o'clock start.
Oh, boy. I know. That's going to be a nerve-wracking game, I think, for fans to watch. Some of the other things we want to talk about is that the Pettersson penalty, which I know people have very strong thoughts about.
Yeah, he left his feet, which you're not supposed to do. It's just a very odd call for charging. I mean, he did, I'm not sure who he hit, but I think it was Brett Kulak. He hit him high. I mean, it was a bit of an odd game. The referee calls for sure, maybe both ways. There were, I think fans and players alike would rather, you know, instead of calling stuff that's borderline, just let them play. And, you know, there's a lot of penalties, but I'll say this. The Canucks killed off 5 Edmonton penalties, which is incredible. I mean, the Oilers power play looked really good early, and the Canucks got a big save from Seelovs. And then after that, though, the Canucks were so aggressive. The Oilers' big guys looked a little tired. Maybe all those minutes earlier in the series are catching up to them. But, I mean, if you said you gave the Oilers 5 power plays earlier this series, Edmonton would have scored 2 or 3 out of that, and they got 0. And that was the as much a big part of the game as just the Canucks' aggression and their forecheck and just the way they kind of, you know, documented terms on their terms.
All right, Barry. All right, prediction then. Do you think they can close it out in 6?
Sure they can. I mean, it's so funny with this series. You think, like, after game 4, it felt like, oh, it feels like maybe Edmonton's got the upper hand, but then the Canucks come right back. And it's been like that the entire series. One team kind of puts their nose ahead and the other team comes back. So, I mean, the Oilers are going, I mean, there's nothing like a desperate hockey team, right?
That's true.
They're going to be really tough to beat in their home rink, but the Canucks can do it for sure. So
I think so.
I wouldn't put anything past them, but if they win, they're in the conference finals for the first time since 2011.
Amazing. Barry, thank you.
All right. Thanks, Simi. I'll talk to you next week in the conference finals, perhaps.
Let's hope so. I would love to talk to you next week, Barry. That's Barry DeLay, sports anchor and reporter at Global. Of course, the Canucks can do it. They're going to do it tomorrow night, too.
This is Mornings with Simi.
Well, just about every parent out there struggles with their child in those teenage years, and it is hard. A teenager can suddenly seem like a different person. It's not their fault. They're going through a lot of changes. But could virtual reality actually help them with that whole process? And I'm sure some parents out there certainly hope so, but let's learn more about that now with Dr. Alexandra Kitson, postdoctoral researcher in the Tangible Embodied Child Computer Interaction Lab at Simon Fraser University. Dr. Kitson, thank you for being here.
Hi, thanks for having me.
That is quite the title for a lab. What kind of work do you do there?
Yeah, the Tangible Embodied Child Computer Interaction Lab. It's directed by Dr. Alyssa Antle. And I'm one of her postdoc fellows there for the past 2 years, where I've been studying how virtual reality can help teens learn and practice emotion regulation skills.
Can it actually do that? Can it help them manage their emotions better?
Yeah, well, that's our hypothesis, and we're not having an answer yet. But we think because virtual reality's ability to evoke visceral emotional responses can enable a world where teens can practice emotion regulation skills. And because it has this ability to track your body and track your hands and feel like you're really there, it can provide feedback and skills training in a space where messing up doesn't really matter.
So how does it do that? How does this work, theoretically?
Yeah. So, for example, a teen could put on a virtual reality headset and they could see this virtual world. Like, imagine you have a fight with a friend because they're hanging out with their new partner. And so you feel disrespected and frustrated and think they don't really care about you. So instead of blowing up at them and getting angry, you go into a virtual space where you have a simulation of a conversation with a friend. And because we have AI technologies as well that can provide more conversations that feel like you're talking to someone, they can practice talking to their friend and they can try it out and see, like, well, if I said this to my friend, like, how might they react? Or that didn't work, like, restart the virtual reality app and see if I can try again.
So if they're afraid to have a conversation and say something that might upset people or make them mad or whatever, they can practice first.
Yes, exactly.
Right. Okay. Is there not a concern, though, that it's not real enough, that perhaps what they're talking about on the VR will not happen in real life?
And yeah, we can never know what's going to happen in real life. But we're thinking that it's somewhere between rehearsing it in your head and then having an actual conversation with the friend. So it's kind of a practice that is as realistic as we can get it compared to other kinds of media.
Right. Okay. So how do you program the virtual reality to respond in this way? Does artificial intelligence play a role in all this?
It can. We're using this game engine called Unity to program. It's where you can program 3D environments. Many games that people play are using this kind of engine. And it just allows you to track your hands and your body. So when you're looking through a virtual reality headset, you're interacting with the world as if you are in real life.
Right. Is this a natural progression, do you think, for teens who are kind of computer savvy or perhaps already gamers?
Yeah, exactly. But not only for them. We're looking at how we can integrate gamified elements into the experience, hoping that maybe something like virtual reality or a gamified version of it could be appealing and motivating for teens Whereas if they went to a counselor's office, they might give them a worksheet for homework. Well, what if they could play a game instead?
So what do you mean a gamified version? So you want them to turn to this particular program for advice, but then you're going to reward them for doing that?
Yeah, yeah. So we're working with psychologists and educators to make sure that we're integrating the mechanism of change. So the part of therapy we know that works, and making sure that's included in the game, but then we can have fun with it and make it appealing to teens.
Is there also a concern here, though, Dr. Kitson, that perhaps we're encouraging a reliance on something computerized versus actual in-person contact, going to your parents, for instance, or a friend to ask these questions?
Mm-hmm. And I would definitely prefer teens if they went to their parents or their friends for advice. But sometimes we don't want to share those things with them. Maybe we're afraid of judgment. Or sometimes teens don't have access to these kinds of supports. And I've been studying that as well. Some teens going into the metaverse, like a program called VR Chat, which is an like online VR chat program. And they're going there for emotional support where they're not getting it at home.
Interesting. Well, thank you so much for talking about it with us.
Yeah, thanks for having me.